Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mod State Podcast. This is the Weekend Beat. And on this Weekend Beat, John and I go ahead and review and talk about the relevance of the book Animal Farm by George Orwell. Maybe one of my favorite George Orwell novels, barring 1984. But anyway, we get into the relevance of that book and talk about the plot a bit. But as always, if you like Mod State, go to modstate.com, find all the links to our social media outlets, links to the podcast, and all of our op-ed and opinion pieces. We appreciate your continued support, and I trust that you're having a wonderful 2018. We'll see you. Let's get John on the line. Welcome back, dude. So we're going to dive right into it. I realize you're not as big of a Super Troopers fan, but again, I think it's one of those movies where you just get it or you don't get it. I don't know what it is, but I don't think you could watch it again and really, I don't know. I mean,
I can see it again. I've only seen that like twice is the thing in my defense here. I'm not saying that The Big Lebowski is funnier. I might still feel that way after seeing Super Troopers again, but I haven't seen Super Troopers since I enlisted in 2011.
Oh, okay. Well, I think if I had to pick between Super Troopers and The Big Lebowski, I would have to say I'd go with The Big Lebowski because there's just so many references.
The characters are immutable.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like, even the references to, like, Ty Stick and I don't know. Here, hold on. But yeah, I don't know. I think...
Don't you dare delete my F-bomb.
I didn't. There's no editing of F-bombs.
You should totally delete it.
No, we don't edit on the show.
It was entirely necessary, though. It wasn't like it was an F-bomb about Adolf Hitler or Benito Mussolini or even Soylent Green or Saul Yurick and the Warriors. You got to delete that F-bomb. I mean, sorry, Smokey. This is not NOM. There are rules.
There are rules. Market zero.
Can you imagine this huge loon pulls out a gun in a bowling alley?
I don't know. Maybe in my top five favorite scenes of all time when he pulls the 9mm on Smokey. I don't know.
It's a world of pain. and then Walter, put away the peace, man. They're calling the cops.
Man, you're pretty spot on with those impressions.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? One day, I won't be too broke to pay attention. One day, somebody's gonna be like, "Hey, this podcast, they've got a really great guy as the host, really salient with his arguments, really moral guy, and then they've got this Catholic from New Orleans who, pretty much a jackass, but he does great impersonations. We should totally syndicate these guys, hey."
Oh, okay. I'll match your F-bomb with one of my favorite, two-line, three-liners in The Big Lebowski. What is it? Shut the fuck up, Donnie.
You're out of your element.
You're out of your element. And the scene
Poor
when
Donnie.
And the scene when they're spreading his ashes, and the
oh my god.
And the ashes. Just spoiler alert: Donnie dies. For those
poor of you. Donnie.
Poor Donnie.
In the movie, he's just in the bowling alley. He's just trying to talk.
That's it.
You're out of Donnie. You're out of. No, Vladimir Ilyin. I am the walrus.
I am the walrus.
Everybody who has not seen these movies has already turned this podcast off, but either way, it's okay, because if you haven't seen either of these two movies, you in all likelihood, you guessed it, probably suck.
Yeah, probably. You probably do suck. If you haven't seen Super Troopers or The Big Lebowski, you suck.
That's a bad tandem to miss. That's like not knowing what Star Trek or Star Wars is, or not knowing who the Beatles or the Rolling Stones are, or Tupac and Biggie,
yeah,
America and the USSR.
really, maybe even worse, not being able to delineate between Star Trek and Star Wars.
Steve Bannon or Donald Trump. That'd be pretty bad.
That would be bad. Although, I don't know. It actually might be funny if you couldn't delineate between Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. I wouldn't be as mad about that.
Well, you know, when he first became emperor, Napoleon Bonaparte commissioned a search in France and Italy, which more or less voluntarily joined the cause. I mean, they're two very similar countries, after all, two old-school Catholic countries. And he commissioned a search amongst the media to find anyone who had not heard of them or of him. And finally, yes, he did. And finally, like quite a few miles from Paris, they found an old man who lived in a cabin by himself in the woods. And it was a woodcutter for a living. And he had no clue what had gone on in the French Revolution or anything.
How could you?
He didn't know who Napoleon was. I'm going, even back then without the internet, how could you not know?
How could you not know the French Revolution was happening?
Yeah, he's like, Napoleon? Who's that? And now, I don't know the rest of the story. Napoleon was a benevolent guy. You know, he gave the Jews sanctuary in Palestine, the Palestinian territory, you know, and he brought back the Catholic Church. And, you know, he was about as benevolent a dictator as they come. But I never heard, I even read his memoirs, and he never mentioned it beyond commissioning the report. I always wondered, I mean, it would seem... Mike, you'd probably be like, you know what?
Well,
that man a knighthood.
Would it be in propaganda's best interest to not mention someone who did not know who he was? I don't know.
You know, Napoleon, he had a pretty decent sense of humor. I mean, he embraced the whole, I'm glad the English think I'm short even though I'm not thing.
You know,
he commissioned paintings.
They're
short when they exhumed his body, and he wasn't.
I was going to say there was I don't know if it was conspiracy or speculation that he actually wasn't as short as.
Oh no, they exhumed his body, and he was about 5'7" at the time, which was average height. But he embraced that whole England always in their comics, painted him as short next to the line of England, and he embraced that. Like if you notice any of the official paintings of him. He was short.
Yeah, interesting.
Kind of like the Scottish, when the English made them start wearing kilts, they're like, oh, you're not going to humiliate us. We're going to come up with a pattern, a plaid pattern for each of our families. This is going to be a thing of pride.
Well, I guess that's the way to do it, right? Instead of just wallowing in self-pity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, embrace the suck.
Well, you know, you did bring up F-bombs and Hitler and whatnot. You could have said Stalin, because I think...
I didn't want to.
Oh, I see. You're
I was leaving. I was handing the ball off.
I see. You're leaving the segues to me, if you will. The transitions. The host. Oh, thanks. That's so kind of you. Well, this is the Weekend Beat, and thanks for tuning in. We are going to be talking about The Big Lebowski and Super Troopers. No, we are not. Maybe we should do The Big Lebowski at some point for a Weekend Beat. That would be, there's absolutely no historical or perspective relevance to that in the political climate.
Except in Nam.
Except for Nam.
There were allegedly rules. No, allegedly. First I've heard of that.
Yeah.
Last I checked, they had pikes and, you know, pits, you know, for, anyway.
Well, what we are planning to do is do a little expose on the 1984 allegorical novella, if you will, by George Orwell. So this was first published in 1945.
Wait a minute, 1984?
No, Animal Farm. Did I say 1984?
You did.
Oh, good catch. Excuse me.
I was going to say, this would be two very different stories there.
Animal Farm is an allegorical novella by George Orwell. It was published in
1984 is truth.
Truth. So the Orwell wrote this book, and I guess he said that it was about the events leading up to the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the Stalinistic or Stalinist era, if you will, in the Soviet Union.
And I don't like him.
You don't? Who, Stalin or Orwell? Maybe. Well, you might not like him more because he was a democratic socialist. I don't know.
I, I knew that because he wrote 1984, and he got a lot of criticism from the center left in England, which it's like,
I guess England did it still matter then.
So if this redeems him, he is a critic, or was a critic, of Joseph Stalin. So
he loved Jesus.
So he wrote this book. It was published in 1945, and it became a he believed that Stalin. I mean, he was a brutal dictator, and he wrote the book in a way that he sort of professed that Stalin was built on this cult of personality. And then, of course, he enforced his reign with a reign of terror.
He did have a bitching staff. A stash, rather.
Oh, Joseph Stalin. Okay, he did. I will give you that.
Was like a simpler guy from Office Space.
Yeah. Yes.
My comrade.
So it was, I think the original title, not that it matters, but it was The Animal Farm, A Fairy Story. And for whatever reason, they just made it Animal Farm. And
A
Fairy Story. And I guess U.S. publishers dropped that subtitle when it was published in 1946.
They did not want to imply that homosexuals came and took your teeth from under your pillow.
I didn't even take it that way, but you got me. So Time Magazine eventually chose this book as one of the 100 best English novels from 1923 to 2005. It was featured as number 31 in the Modern Library list of best 20th century novels, and it won a retrospective Hugo Award in 1996 and is included in the Great Books of Western World.
You don't have to tell me where it ranked.
I'm going to.
Please tell me. No, not Animal Farm.
Oh.
Please tell me that 1984 was on that list.
You know what? We're going to find out right now because I have the internet, and I am sure.
You've got the intranets?
The intranets? Let's see. I believe it. Probably. So, okay. Well, here we go. So, 1984...
Don't say if it ranked above the book we're talking about.
Well, I'm going to, because we're going to review it. So 2005, man, on a
similar site is a review.
In 2000, so Time obviously made this list in 2005. They chose, it was also in the 100 best English language novels. It was awarded a place on both lists of Modern Library 100 best novels, reaching number 13 on the editor's list and 6 on the reader's list. And in 2003, the novel was listed at number 8 on the BBC survey of the Big Read. Well, so it he's got that's some cred right there, man.
You know what? It's not number 1 on any of those, and they introduced it in the top 5 to the Library of Congress, and I'm discouraged. But anyway, let's talk about your precious pigs and Animal Farms.
The precious pigs and...
get off my sorrows.
Okay, listen, I've got to find out what the number one book is. Let's find out. I'm going to find out right now.
Don't you back talk me. I'm going to slap you in the penis.
Let's see. Well, there is F. Scott Fitzgerald is definitely on there. And,
Mockingbird.
That is probably... on there as well. Now, how come when you search on Google...
Nightingale, sorry.
How is it that when you search Okay, well...
done.
Well, yeah, so
I think we should shut down Mondstadt.
It's done. Mondstadt's done. Look at what a horrible researcher I am. I just picked on the first link, and it gave me... You gave me nothing.
Probably gave you, a Michael Jackson sale link, little boy's pants half off, and now you're being tracked by the government.
Well, there we go. It appears that the 100 best novels, I don't know if this is ranked or not specifically, but it's The Adventures of Augie March.
You have 100 best without a ranking.
I don't know. Well, All the King's Men. But these are...
All the King's Men.
This is not in that was an alphabetical order. So that doesn't.
That's a bullshit poll. Just like this is turning into a bullshit podcast.
Sure is. Wow, these are this apparently I have to read this list. Kafka on the Shore, and
the Bible
on Beauty.
Had better Prep, be in there.
Saturday, Veronica. Nonfiction of this, Assassin's Gate. Yeah, these are bullshit lists. I don't know what this is. All right, let's get on to Animal Farm. This is digressing quickly.
I don't even know what we're talking about. I don't even know that I've read the book anymore. I think I've gone backwards.
You've progressed.
It's like a Penrose Triangle for my intelligence.
Well, whatever. Animal Farm in 1984, we're pretty high on the list. Okay, no, so
Animal Farm, stick to one.
God, I know. All right, so Animal Farm, plot summary here. So obviously we know that this is based on Stalin's precursor to his reign. But really the meat of this story is there's a pig, right? Old Major, who essentially summons the animals on the farm together for a meeting. And that's where he introduces the humans as enemies. And then, of course, teaches the animals, the beasts of England.
I like him already.
Yeah, there you go. So Old Major dies. And so I think Old Major is actually he's supposed to be Karl Marx, the creator of what would be communism. And so when Major dies, the two young pigs, Snowball and Napoleon, assume command and consider it a duty to basically prepare for the rebellion. And they coined the phrase, or they adopt what I think it's seven commandments of animalism. And the most important is all animals are equal. So that sort of sets the stage.
Yeah, it sets the stage for some bullshit right there.
Yeah, that does sound like some bullshit.
That's some of that old bullshit. Mm-hmm. That's not very American, for one thing. I mean, since when have they ever made any of us feel like they care or
we're equal, but everything seems to be going well. The pigs teach the animals to read and write. Napoleon educates young puppies on the principle of animalism, which, of note, he sort of took those puppies away, and they'll come back at a later point. You know, food is plentiful. The farm's
running. I hope they come back floating.
Oh, how dare you?
I mean, swimming.
Oh, okay. I see. So the food is plentiful. The farm's running fine. And then the pigs, they sort of elevate themselves to positions of leadership. They start setting aside special food items, quote unquote, for their personal health and well-being. So fast forward a little bit down the road. Some of the farmers have some issues with what's going on at Animal Farm. They attack the farm. They wound up, on this particular attack.
When the pigs lead the charge?
Yep. So
if you could quit the naysaying against the police at any time, feel free to exercise that option.
Fair enough. So Snowball the pig leads the ambush, defeat the men in a surprise attack, and of course his popularity soars. And the events proclaim the Battle of the Cowshed, and it's celebrated annually. Well,
so they had CSA generals naming these battles?
I guess. Yeah, I guess.
Cowshed, Battle of Bull Run.
So there's a point now where the two pigs are vying for dominance, and this is where the Napoleon, who's been training these puppies, has them chase away Snowball, and now Napoleon is the declared leader. So he sort of changes the governance of the farm, and he replaces the annual meetings of all the animals with just a committee of pigs. And they build this windmill, and this is sort of the pride of the farm, but obviously the pigs aren't working on this. The animals are working. You remember the old horse Boxer was working diligently. He was so committed to the cause, and
that was his first mistake.
Exactly. So of course the windmill collapses, and
Elmer's glue.
Well, that does happen, so don't, spoiler alert. So they obviously there's a collapse of this windmill during a storm, and this is where Napoleon he starts to convince them that Snowball, the exiled pig, is trying to sabotage their project, and Snowball becomes the scapegoat. And Snowball the scapegoat. So he begins to purge the farm with his sidekick dogs. He kills animals accused of consorting with this old rival. And, you know, they, some of the animals start, there's some dissonance going on. They recall the Battle of the Cowshed, you know, where they're like, I'm pretty sure Snowball was the one that maybe led the charge, but, you know, they're not quite sure. So there's sort of this dissonance going on. So then there's another battle. One of the neighboring farms attack the windmill. They blow the windmill up. And now there's a Boxer the Workhorse was wounded. And despite his injuries, he continued to work harder until he finally collapsed. And of course, Napoleon says, look, we're doing what's best. All animals are equal. We'll get the surgeon to check him out. He'll get better care there. And the donkey, Benjamin, finds out that the van that picked up was actually the glue factory van. And he lets the animals know. And of course, the pigs come out and they're like, no, that's not the way it is. Look, the van was purchased by the vet. They didn't have time to change the sign on the van. And look, you know, it's not what you think it is.
And so then, in the audiobook, these two could be voiced by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. No, we're not taking away your care. We're
giving you more options. We're giving you more options. Yeah, yeah.
So, it's not the Gulf War. There are rules.
So the pigs decide to hold a festival after Boxer's death, and they further praise the glories of Animal Farm, and they, of course, have the animals work even harder, taking on Boxer's duties. Of course, Boxer's the horse, the Clydesdale, that is the strong one. So
he didn't get to go to Budweiser.
No, he did not, which is funny transition, because the pigs start to buy or use money to buy whiskey for themselves.
And, you're welcome.
Yes. So, of course, this just goes on. Years pass, the windmill's rebuilt, and the farm makes good income from it. But the ideals from which Snowball discussed, including, you know, this idea of stalls with electric lighting, heating, running water, they're all forgotten. And with Napoleon advocating, you know, that the happiest animals live simple lives, the life that the pigs
serfs.
The lives that the pigs are living are much, much better. So, of course, over time, you know, the animals that have participated in the revolution wind up dying. The farmer Jones, who originally owned the farm, died in another part of England.
How did the puppies fare?
I don't know. I'm sure they just made more puppies and they were just at the bidding of the pigs.
They ate turds and
sure.
Charged and bit innocent people, right?
And sniffed buttholes. So, the pigs start to reassemble. Or they start to resemble humans. Yeah. The pigs start to walk upright. They carry whips. They wear clothes.
They're white now.
What's that?
So they're white now.
I guess. I guess so, yeah.
Managed to walk upright, finally. Mm-hmm.
They've evolved.
Their faces blue and carrying whips.
So now, this is the most important part. So if you remember from the beginning, the seventh commandments, the most important one was that all animals are created equal. But this this gets changed to all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. So Napoleon holds a dinner party. This is towards the end. Napoleon holds a dinner party for the pigs and local farmers. And they celebrate this new alliance, and he abolishes the practice of revolutionary traditions and restores the name the Manor Farm. And as the animals look from pigs to humans, they realize they can no longer distinguish between the two. Dun dun dun. So yeah, so that that's kind of the plot. And
so you take one trope from this novel, one primary methodology, if you will, sir, and you described a precast. I take another, but describe yours. And it's kind of interesting, you and I have actually, truth be told, never discussed this book before.
No.
So
I said, what to take from this? And I think I told you this in the beginning when we were precasting. So why is this relevant? Of course, I don't for a second believe that
for whatever reason, like we talk about relevance, that I think that our democracy is destined for communism and or some sort of Stalinist type regime. But there are things in this book that I believe are relevant, and that would be the scapegoating. And what the two things, actually. One would be the scapegoating, and we've seen this sort of transform and evolve from the Obama era into, well, I mean, it really has been since 2001, since 9/11, but there's a, you know, we see the advent of Islamophobia. We see with the current administration.
You mean scapegoating?
Scapegoating, yeah.
So I thought that was in 1974. Sorry.
You see the scapegoating for the woes of this world in the United States from immigrants that are coming across the border, people that don't look like us. There's that scapegoating. And of course, we've seen scapegoating in history and the devastation that and the denigration of different cultures because of scapegoating.
Jews are never liked anywhere.
No, unfortunately. And so that being one, and I think it's the responsibility of any citizen to realize when that's being used. And I really think from an evolutionary standpoint that we do look at someone else who's different. And I think there's something genetically that just drives us to maybe not, I think we have to work harder to accept everyone than we have to do to be suspicious of another group of people. And I just think that's an evolutionary it was something that helped us when we lived in tribes, when someone wasn't our family member, didn't look like us, that we were suspicious of that person. But this is 2017. We don't have to do that. The other thing that I see relevant here is this idea, and maybe this is more of a 1984 reference, but I do believe that it's...
Don't do it. Don't you dare steal my thunder.
Well, you go ahead, because maybe I believe... especially what we see today, it's the disillusion of facts. And we see it for, I mean, I don't mean to pick on the administration, but they really...
trying to tell me that 2 + 2 does not equal 5.
No, it does not. That's fake news. So you
no
see...
No wonder I suck as an economics major.
There is... when you are able to pick and choose what facts are real and what facts are not, there's a danger in that. And the administration has done a good job of creating this, it's this new phrase, this fake news, where if facts don't fit the current reality, or if you don't like the current reality, you can create your own facts, or you can...
Are you crediting the Trump administration?
I am crediting the Trump administration.
Creating that phrase?
I don't know. Maybe they did or maybe they didn't, but they certainly have increased its popularity if they didn't.
After President Obama said we all live in our own bubble, and he forgot all about Saul Alinsky and the Cloud Piven strategy, you can't be serious.
Well, but did he...
Let's not lay all the blame, as popular as it is, on Donald John Trump here.
Okay, fine. I will not. I think maybe it is in my best interest to...
It's in your best interest as a progressive to continue to do so. But in the interest of fairness here, can you really say that Donald Trump brought us to this place? Or is he a symptom?
I don't necessarily... see that plug. It isn't...
I'm not plugging anything.
No. I don't necessarily believe that Donald Trump himself claimed to have invented fake news, but whether or not, I mean, I agree with you when I say whatever reality you want to create or whatever facts you want to agree with or not agree with, that's not a new thing in 2017, but I most definitely believe the popularity has been increased since Donald Trump made it. That's fake news. Just outwardly saying you're fake news. CNN, whatever you say is fake news.
It's part of the human condition, the fact that we suppress things that are unfortunate in our view.
Well,
small assault.
Are you suppressing?
We don't like.
There's a difference between suppressing and suppressing.
And relabeling, is there?
I just feel like there's a difference between suppressing facts and just being confronted with facts and saying it's just fake because it doesn't fit your narrative.
So how does that make you feel about the fact that, again, it was a 77-0 vote, meaning there was a vast absence of
in the vote in the Senate regarding the commission that led grand jury charges with only Democrats in private meetings between judge and lawyers, in the what led Richard Nixon to resign. I mean, how do you justify that?
So I'll walk back my statement. Donald Trump did not. He is not the advent of fake news or the inventor.
I know what you meant.
Yes. I mean, I think there's historical examples of fake news in propaganda, spreading lies. Ramses the Great did it. Medieval times, there was fake news in Italy that claimed the Jewish community had murdered. It was back in, I think it was in like 1975, or 1475 rather, some fake news about a Jewish community that had murdered a Christian infant. I mean, there's all these.
The same thing happened during the Jack the Ripper era, okay? I mean, they got blamed for the murders of prostitutes. I'm going, well, okay, I'm pretty sure every ethnic group has slain a prostitute.
Well, I'm...
At any rate, continue with your take from the book. I had to plug in the whole Nixon injustice.
And that's good, because, again, I will say what is popular in 2017, 2018, when a narrative is created based on not believing the facts or just outright disbelief of evidence that's presented to you. So like in the case of Benjamin the Donkey saying like, hey, I'm pretty sure that that's the glue factory van. Oh, no. You don't know. I know. That's fake news. That's not what it is. And you can just go with it. I mean, the instinct for Benjamin to say like, I think this is not what it seems, but no, it's not. And if you are a sheep and you do follow, it was absolutely exactly what he thought it was. So, you know, I think any democracy overall runs the risk of having a plot similar to these satirical stories if you're not careful. And I just believe, just like Stalin, you know, this, I'm not saying the United States is destined for that, but I do believe that there needs to be a responsibility and a cautious and suspicion, because things like this don't happen overnight. They don't, I mean, coups happen overnight, and that's very true, but in an established democracy like this, to go from democracy to something like a Stalinistic regime, I just think it would be an insidious sort of progression towards that. And, you know, in this case, Animal Farm points that out very clearly, that it was what seemed to be in the values and principles that were established sort of just denigrated over time. And once it finally was in full swing, people, you know, these animals were realizing that. But anyway, that's my take. How about yours? I apologize.
No, it's fun. Mine's rather, I suppose it's more of a one bravo than a second point, but I looked at it kind of from the perspective, and this is not original. I read it somewhere years ago. I apologize to whoever, because I can't credit you now. This was literally years ago, but that it was a critique of tin pot nations that when they want to overthrow these horrible despots, that then all of a sudden they find out that the new leaders are worse than the ones prior.
Very true.
And so it's kind of this, and you see that. I mean, we've seen that recently in the Middle East. We've seen it in the southern portion of the Western Hemisphere, that all of a sudden there's this great push to get rid of these horrible leaders. And then, next thing you know, there's worse people in power. Mm-hmm. Or it seems they are. So, I mean, it's much easier to synopsize, but that was kind of my take from it.
Well, I mean, it's true. I mean, you can even look at that with Gaddafi in Libya. I mean, that was a horrific regime in itself. There was stability there, but
they handed over their nuclear program.
They did.
In 03, 04.
Mm-hmm.
When they got asked to, Gaddafi looked around the Middle East and went, holy shit. Y'all come get them.
Yeah. You come get them. It's a eBay. You just come get them and get rid of them.
Then, you know, I'm sure they disappeared into Eastern Europe and then
somewhere else.
But whatever. But the guy did what we asked, and I mean, personally, I disagree with that decision to remove him, because now we have what we have.
Yeah, well, I think leaders won't admit that it was the wrong thing to do. Of course, it's a retrospective Monday morning quarterback looking back, going, oops, you know, that was, I mean, you could even make that case for Saddam Hussein in Iraq.
You can't do that. Just like you can talk nepotism about Donald Trump and Jared Kushner, but you can't talk nepotism about John F. Kennedy appointing his brother to Attorney General.
Oh, I can say that's nepotism, 100%.
Well, you're one of the few.
Oh, I talked
to one of few progressives, Democrats on the center left that are like, oh, well, nepotism and all with Jared Kushner. Oh, really?
Hey, look, at a minimum, we can you agree that the nepotism conducted by Kennedy at the time was maybe more productive for the progression of the United States than the nepotism of Donald Trump and Jared Kushner? Although
I can't verify that now, but I will say that Robert F. Kennedy, God rest his soul, was very effective at his job, mm-hmm. and the Kennedys appeared always to do their utmost, in particularly in reference to the civil rights movement. So I can't render full judgment at this time, which you're not asking me to do, but it's very young yet.
I will.
Donald John Trump.
I was going to say,
convicted of anything, but in retrospect, yes.
I will ask this question.
Was very worthy of his position.
True. I will give this. I will ask this question in 3 years.
Oh, I mean, it's fair to ask, you know, as far as, I mean, that's what we do, is to evaluate things as they go along. It's a fair thing to ask. I mean, in retrospect, yeah, he was worthy of his position. But it's worth pointing out simply because the people don't want to point out, oh, that's his son-in-law. Yeah, well, it's not his brother.
Yeah, very true.
I know that he's got the eternal flame and all, but that doesn't mean that John F. Kennedy was without sin, if you will. Mm. But I know not you, but that's just a kind of a general. There's very much a double standard here, again, because we don't, quote unquote, like this man. But again, it feeds back in. This book is incredibly relevant.
Yeah.
And worth of consideration, especially when you see all the moving pieces here.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why I wanted to do it. But yeah, we're just about 40 minutes. I feel like this was a good weekend beat. For the listeners out there, I did want to take the opportunity to, hey, if you've got any suggestions, anything you'd like us to cover on the weekend beat, it doesn't need to be a movie, it doesn't need to be a book, it can be any sort of pop culture sort of thing, please send it our way. You can find me on Twitter at @modstate_Nate. You can go to Twitter at @themodstate or Facebook or wherever you can, Podomatic, I think you have the opportunity to do that. You can do it on iTunes, wherever you find your podcasts, and just reach out to us and we'll gladly cover it. I think we'd like to cover what? Like the Rolling Stones, 1984, Big Lebowski, Super Troopers.
Rolling Stones.
Yeah, that would be like a 3 or 4 part weekend beat.
Are you kidding me? They've been around since 64.
I know. Well, maybe pick a time period.
I mean, I think we could perhaps get on Patreon and let people consider that. I mean, if they want us to be around for a fourth, if you want us to be around for the next presidential election, which I know you weren't around at the time, you were still in the Army, but I think based on my performance during the presidential election alone, we're worthy of that. But, I mean, who am I to say that, you know?
We'll discuss, I believe. So
we'll probably be around for the next presidential election.
I would like to be.
I don't know any reason right now that we won't, unless one of us just happens to trail off.
I don't know. We'll find out. I plan on not. Anyway, we'll be back this week with our regular episodes and then to next weekend, and I'm looking forward to it as always, my friend.
This was 75 worth of episodes, by the way.
You're right. 75.
Beautiful. Like 75.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, my friend,
au revoir.
We'll see you.